I know a lot of you are writing, and therefore it seems to me that I think the right way to go is that we will finish this section and do the transition to reason and then stop. I don't know how long it's going to take us to do that. It might be done this week, in which case next week I'll have an open session, or we'll carry on until next week. I mean, I just don't know. But I think it's probably not wise to try to do observing reason now. That seems like a big leap. And I know you're all busy writing it, where you won't be reading about observing reason, so let's not pretend. So the plan is just to finish the unhappy consciousness and do the transition to reason. That's the first five or so pages of the chapter on reason. And we'll pick up with there next semester. Okay, any mechanical questions? Good. So whether a meeting week 15 or not, we'll just see how it goes. Okay, last week I gave an account of stoicism and skepticism, and what I wanted to argue was that stoicism and skepticism were forms of self-consciousness, and in particular, they were forms of divided consciousness. That is, they exemplified the structure of the duality, or Hegel generated, phenomenologically deduced, the duality between transcendental and empirical consciousness, and therefore the duality between universality and particularity, between knowledge and freedom, between truth and being. So stoicism and skepticism, a lot of blank faces. So, right, so the claim, just to remind you, I'm going to say a bit more about it in a second, but that the Stoic, right, who is the slave in the mode of knowledge, thinking that what freedom the slave has is the freedom of thought, and that thought will represent universality. And that is, in the case of the Stoic, going to be opposed to nature. And then with the skeptic, we said that the skeptic wants to make actual, through its effort, what was only in principle true in the place of Stoicism, namely, I am everything, the world is nothing. And therefore, the Stoic, Stoic is really a principle of freedom, exemplifies why? Because the skeptic exemplifies the negativity of consciousness. It takes all of the conceptual phenomenon of Stoicism, gives it a nominalist interpretation. Nominalism is the assertion of the primacy of will over knowledge. And then, once interpreting that way, then interprets all universality as convention. All convention is arbitrary, therefore as nothing. So in its freedom, it takes that negativity to be the thought of existence. So, thought and being are represented by the two aspects of consciousness, represented by Stoicism and Skepticism. And this we know in terms of Kantianism, right? This would be one version of the transcendental self, which is self-identical. And that can go either way. That is, it's part of the claim of the transcendental, that it is indifferently knowledge or will, so that in the relationship between Stoicism and Skepticism, you get that uniquely German idealist equivocation about reason and will, and that the other side becomes the empirical self. And the skeptic recognizes that it is two-sided in a way that the Stoic repudiates, right? And that's why it recognizes that it needs the empirical stuff in order to negate it. For those of you who want to think about this distinction, Stoicism and Skepticism, you can say the same claims about God. That is, you can have an either rationalist God or a existentialist God. That is, you can think that if you're a Thomist, you say that God is all-knowing because he sees the truth. That is, that's a kind of Thomistic, Platonic interpretation of God. But if you're an alchemist, you'll say that God knows the truth because he creates the truth. He makes it true, right? So there's this continual relationship that then enters into modernity as this tension between knowing and willing. And therefore, my claim last week was once we see the origin of the relationship between transcendental and empirical in skepticism, then we can immediately understand that Kant's construction of the transcendental and empirical distinction is itself necessarily skeptical. It's a version of skepticism. It comes out of skepticism. And I further said that skepticism itself is not an a priori or immediate idea, but itself we saw as a fully conditioned position within the history of consciousness. Well, let me present all of that in a different register. And I want to do that in part because you look baffled, and in part because there's a lovely account of Stoicism and Skepticism in Stanley Rosen's book, Hegel's Introduction. And I like it so much that I thought you should not be deprived of it. And his rhetorical version, I think, will help show you some of the significance of this. Rosen's way of getting into the problem is to say that Stoicism emerges from slavery, and that's, remember, the background to all of this, right? A certain version of slave consciousness. Stoicism emerges from slavery through the rejection of the situation of alienating labor as unreal. So what really motivates Stoicism, right, is the fact that it is divided. It has an experience of its freedom in thinking about how to produce objects, but an experience of deep alienation because it labors to produce objects that are then taken away by the master. And the only way that a slave can affirm that dawning sense of affirmation that it does have, and the dawning sense of affirmation that it is right to have, its experience of self-overcoming, is in some way to claim that that moment of the object being taken away does not matter. It is unreal. So the Stoic finds within the thought of the freedom of thinking the freedom that he is denied in his actual historical world. And Rosen says something very interesting here. And a surprising thing for him to say of all people. I say that because those of you who know Rosen's writings will know. Those of you who don't, I'll tell you. He is probably the last living true Platonist who believes completely in intellectual intuition. I've had arguments with him where he'll just, you know, at a certain moment say, you have to see it. Pointing to the idea is if you don't have the intellectual intuition, then you're just in trouble. I keep telling him there's no intuition to have, and we go back and forth. Anyway, so what he has to say here is interesting. He says at this point, we need to understand how Hegel sees the difference between Stoicism and Socratism, or Platonism, or the Socratic tradition. And he says that, in general, the Socratic tradition, the philosophy of the aristocratic city-state, does not take work seriously. Now, there's a famous line by John Dewey, which I much admire. And he says, Platonism was only possible in a slave society in which some worked and some watched. That is, only in a world where there were those who were free from labor could the idea that forms or universals had nothing to do with making arise. So, Platonism is a version of the philosophy of masters. It is the consolation of the philosopher king, and now I'm quoting, in daydreaming about the work of his slaves. Platonism avoids the transformation of Stoicism and skepticism by experiencing the disappearance of self-consciousness, or the self-conscious philosopher, in the intellectual intuition. And the intellectual intuition is a form of death. Right? In being immediately aware of what is unchanging, one is no longer living. Right? This is why Socrates says all life is a preparation for death. It wasn't an existential thesis. It was an ontological thesis about the meaning of being, namely the ideas, and the idea of being at one with the ideas. Therefore, I take it this is Rosen's point. If Socratism is essentially a form by intellectual intuition of death, then it is intrinsically non-transformable. After all, how can you transform the dead? So it is no accident that Hegel wants to think about the meaning of thought or reason or universality immediately in relationship to laboring and activity, and to think of self-consciousness from the get-go as bound up with transformative activity, because if that were not the case, then self-consciousness could not have a history, could not be transformable, could not, as it were, generate a path. Rosen's way of putting this is to say that the Platonist dies because of his refusal to work. Conversely, the Stoic is born in an incomplete but nevertheless genuine human experience of work, and gives rise to the skeptic as a virile expression of his own incertitude. Stating the same thought somewhat differently, we could say that Platonism is the repudiation of work by a master, while Stoicism is a denial of the significance of work by a slave. So the first thing to understand is why it is, how it is, that Hegel has given us the history he has, a history that bizarrely, again, begins with modern epistemology, moves into a kind of mythic setting of the master and slave, and suddenly emerges in the midst of something like the Roman world. And it is a significant fact about the phenomenology, one you will not mistake, that Socrates, Platonism, never appear. That what appear is Greek tragedy and Greek art, Greek poetry, the Greek city-state, but never Platonism. So he might say that for us moderns, philosophy is only possible by turning our back on Platonism. There's nothing to be said to it, of it, or by it. That's an exaggeration. And Hegel will have another moment where he'll talk about Socrates differently. But when Socrates appears for Plato as significant, he appears not as a Platonist, but as a version of a conscientious objector. That is, someone who has a conscience and dies or sacrifices himself for the truth. So Socrates, in that sense, becomes a version of a modern subject. Significantly, no Plato. It's all Neo-Aristotelian all the way through. Make of that what you will. Well, one of the things you must make of it is that the notion of work and labor, which we're going to come back to today, is absolutely central to the entire Hegelian project. Something that Marx recognized and misrecognized, as I'll come back to later this evening. So Stoicism is the first effort of the slave to transform himself into a master. And he does so, well, he does so mostly by dream. And in that respect, he remains within the horizon of Platonism. But of course, because of the construction of his dreaming, namely as a denial of significance of work, also outside it. The essence of the whole, and this is what makes him within the rise of Platonism, is thought separated from life. So it is, I want to be careful here, it is not freedom itself, but the concept of freedom that the Stoic embraces. The thought of freedom. So the Stoic is form without content. The Stoic incorporates the results of his work in thought in a negative sense only. That is, by denying its significance. Rosen contends that for Hegel, this is an incomplete negation, since the content of the real world is preserved only as determination as such, or the very idea of determination, but without actual determinacy. This means that the content of thought has been transformed, I want to say, into a formal structure. I think it's useful to think of the Stoic as a kind of analytic philosopher interested in logical structures. Maybe someone like Badiou, to think of a bad philosopher. I can't resist. Easy shot. You can take an easy shot and go for it. The point is that it's food for thought, these structures, not food for living. That they only work at the level of thought and cannot be transformed into existential structures by their very character, right? By their very character. That's what made me interested in Badiou and his ideas of set theory. So the Stoic believes that he has escaped from the world of nature and from the impulsions of physical reality by ignoring the details, by lacking empirical content, by thinking of it only in general, or, as Hegel puts it, or as the true, or the good, or the set of all sets, or the infinite. The skeptic, on the other hand, completes the negation of the world through the negative work of analytic thinking. And does so in the manner I described earlier. The problem with skepticism is that because the skeptic is himself the product of his own work, then the skeptic shows that he himself is also of no significance. That is, he has no way of pulling himself out of his own negative doubt about everything else. And therefore, he has no way of affirming the force of his own power of negation, since it ends up swallowing itself. So it becomes a kind of empty negativity. And the empty negativity produces a kind of, well, emptiness, a kind of Stoicism, if you wish. And hence you get another version of the inverted world. The rise of the Stoic produces the skeptic, and the assertion of skepticism produces Stoicism. It's there that we ended last week. Any questions before I press on about how to hold all this together?
About Stoicism and skepticism.
Yeah.
I just have a very simple clarification question. A lot of the time when we're talking about Stoicism and skepticism, we're talking about the slave's negative attitude towards work and these things. And that seems right to me in terms of these things. But you also pointed to this other detail in the text, namely, quote, that both the master and the slave have a negative attitude towards the slave's boss. Relationship. And, you know, you pointed out correctly, I think, that you're supposed to see Marcus Aurelius and Epictetus as both potentially Stoics.
Yeah.
So, I think I'm clear on how the slave gets to be a Stoic, but I, in terms of the text and I guess the lectures, I'm not really clear how, why a master would be a Stoic. I mean, especially if Rosen's right, why, I mean, or am I wrong to think that the master is a Stoic?
Well, Hegel actually says two things, and I don't know if they add up.
Yeah, no.
You're right. So, on the one hand, when he actually is pressed on the historical specificity of the moment, he says that it could arise only in a time of universal slavery. So on the one hand, he imagines that the whole thing is a world in which actual freedom, as opposed to the idea of freedom, could not get a grip, could not find traction. And that's his official historical story. His
it's also a form of universal.
Right.
Sorry. Well, you need masters for culture. You need
No, I'm not saying there aren't masters. I'm saying that he's suggesting that the master and the slave are in an analogous predicament.
Okay.
Right? In the sense that some idea of freedom via the experience of slavery has arisen. Right? But that freedom has not been able to find a mechanism for itself. It's important to remember, in thinking about this, Stoicism is a wonderful political philosophy, in the sense that it is the first fully cosmopolitan political philosophy. And it contains the earliest defenses of cosmopolitan thinking, and therefore the fullest defenses of, and here's the crux, of the equality of all human beings. So the notion of freedom that arose in the Roman world via Stoical philosophy had about it a, let's call it a political ideology that had to reverberate on both masters and slaves in a sense. That the world plainly didn't match up to its own pretensions to universalism. Now, why should that matter? That now is the second point.
So that's the historical bit.
The second bit is to recall that Hegel thinks that the crux of the master-slave relationship is a structure of individual self-consciousness. That is, the upshot of the master-slave, the way it emerges as Stoicism, is emerges as a structure of individual self-understanding with master and slave moments to it. So he's imagining, I take it, that in these circumstances, that form of self-consciousness was available to everyone, right? And that therefore there need not have been, and I just want to say need not have been, an intrinsic difference between the attitudes of masters, actual masters, and actual slaves. Right? Therefore, of course, there might have been some masters, let's say our old-fashioned masters, right? And in fact, we think of Roman history, it's actually scattered with them, right? The ones who think they're God and fiddle and all that, and others who imbibe exactly what we think of as the dictates of Roman philosophy. And that's all I think Hegel needs. That is, he needs the two theses, an historical thesis about why anyone in such a world, might inhabit one of these two positions, and the account of the fact that master-slave become these structural attitudes. Not about actual masters and actual slaves, but forms of individual self-consciousness.
When we got to the end of the master and the slave section, he said from that the master is stuck in terms of self-development. He has all of his needs taken care of. And he has a kind of inferior form of recognition, but some form of recognition in which he can affirm himself. So whereas the slave, on the other hand, sees through working on the object that he somehow becomes externalized according to his idea.
Right.
And that's the mechanism that makes him realize selves can be transformed. There are things that can be worked on.
Right.
The ideas.
Right.
But I'm not seeing if the master has all his needs taken care of, and this is such an important point to emphasize that he's kind of spiritually atrophied in a way, how he could ever get into this game of being split between being a master and a slave.
And I thought that's the point of the historical thesis.
Okay.
Hegel just thinks if there's a world of servitude or a world of unfreedom, then the kind of freedom that the slave possesses becomes attractive to everyone. Right? And if you want to think about it in this way, part of Hegel's and nearly everyone else's view about Rome is there was only one free person. Whatever that might mean, right? The very idea of empire and emperor. Right? And that raises problems for everyone with respect to the notion of freedom. And that's why Hegel thinks of it as a culture of domination. There's no full recognition. Other questions about Stoicism and skepticism? Okay.
Can we maybe return to the notion of order? You brought this up last week.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is that the lack of determination from the point of view of the skeptic or not skeptic, stoic, reveals itself in kind of modality form. I was wondering if you could speak to that a little bit more and explain how exactly something determinate comes out of a position that lacks any kind of determinism.
Well, I think Paul's thought is the one that probably does most of the work. That is, boredom is a determinacy. If you think of every formation of boredom, if you think of Madame Bovary, if you think of medieval asceticism, if you think of, you can go through each, if you think of the way Heidegger talks about boredom in the, 1929 lectures. If, you know, each of these occasions, boredom actually is a specific mood of failure to find the world contentful. So it's a mood, so it's the mood that is the result. It's a result, and therefore a determinate result. So it's not the same. In other words, it would only be empty if it was the same as Stoicism. But Hegel's account is it's the upshot of the Stoical movement. It's the upshot of that, and therefore it's a determinate negation, right? It puts you in a mood that you don't want. Namely, instead of ataraxia, you're in boredom. And then you have to, if you're in boredom, then you have to negate it, and now you're starting to be a skeptic. Even to hold on to Stoicism. Because now you have to negate the determinacy of boredom as the way in which you are both in and not in the world. So, I mean, let me put it another way. The emptiness of thought is not itself empty. It's not itself a matter of indifference. Right? On the contrary, the Stoic wanted something very deep out of the formality of thought. Wanted to hold on to a certain type of indifference and didn't think of that as boredom at all. The original project was a form of virtue. So it's the coming over of a mood that reveals the hollowness of your own thinking. That is, it's a determinate mood revealing a certain kind of emptiness.
I mean, the thought will coincide in Stoicism as the non-determinacy of will.
Right.
It's the moment boredom is gone when the will suddenly becomes determinate.
Or needs to become determinate. Needs to do something. Needs to shake itself up. Can't stay with thoughts. So mood here, I want to say, has all the effectivity of a Heideggerian mood, in that sense, right? It really is world revealing, but it reveals a certain kind of failure of existential engagement. Just as it does in Heidegger. Indeed, one might suppose. Yeah, wouldn't. Okay. Okay. So. Now, what we want to do in thinking about the unhappy consciousness is, and it's very, very tricky, is we want to see it as coping with this problem in all its philosophical significance. And I say that it's a kind of challenge because, as we know, Hegel buries his account in this odd account of medieval Christianity. So we're going to have to think hard about what's going on and to try to decode the philosophical meaning of each of these moments and indeed decode the structure as a whole. Well, the unhappy consciousness arises, he says, I think convincingly, is the form of consciousness that accepts both moments, empirical and transcendental. I am both. I am a divided consciousness. That's what I am. And hence accepts and recognizes itself as divided. That's what the skeptic didn't do, right? The skeptic wanted to say, I'm not divided. I am essentially freedom. I'm essentially negativity. And the empirical is nothing. Empirical is not nothing. So the unhappy consciousness is the acknowledgement of itself as a fractured being, half caught in the sensory world of life, embodied and finite, and half in the unchanging world of pure thought, which now becomes, or is thought of, as an unchanging beyond. So, second paragraph of paragraph 206. In Stoicism, self-consciousness is the simple freedom of itself. In skepticism, this freedom becomes a reality, negates the other side of determining existence, but really duplicates itself, and now knows itself to be a duality. Consequently, the duplication which formerly was divided between two individuals, the Lord and the bondsman, is now lodged in one. So this is the completion of the movement I was talking to Adam about. That is, the two moments of Lord and serf in one consciousness has now officially arrived in one form of consciousness that understands itself to be both exactly, to be a fractured consciousness that is both truly master and truly slave. The duplication of self-consciousness within itself, which is the essential in the notion of spirit, is thus here before us, but not yet in its unity. The unhappy consciousness is the consciousness of self as a dual nature and merely contradictory being. So we're going to understand Christianity as essentially contradictory being, as essentially the experience of the self as a kind of contradictory being. Now, in order to think of yourself as divided consciousness, the question is, how are you going to do that? How are you going to make sense of that experience? How are you going to articulate it? And Hegel's unequivocal thought that runs, by the way, throughout this book, and we're going to come back to it again in a different way in the chapter on religion, is the genius of Christianity is its subtlety and complexity in thinking about human beings as essentially forms of divided consciousness. That is, it's the first form of consciousness that really saw that as problematic. That didn't simply start with, you know, oh, a myth, we were once unborn souls and we got born, bad news, eventually we'll get back to... No, there's a problem here, and the problem is, how are these two moments going to be connected? Right? And Christianity bites the bullet that this is a thought and a problem that needs to be thought through. That's the glory of Christianity. By the way, it never gets there. Never figures it out. But it's fascinating. Its forms of failure are going to be indicative of who we are. So thinking about the forms, if Christianity is essentially a deep thinking in the form of ritual, in the form of practice, in the form... So Hegel thinks, and we want to be clear, that practices, belief systems, cultural practices, the sacraments, the rituals of Christianity, and particular events, and here the Crusades will be an event, need to be interpreted as thoughts, as categorical thoughts. And what I mean by categorical thoughts is thoughts designed to solve real, intransigent, categorical problems. Namely, in this case, well, in part, the problem between mind and body, between thought and existence, between freedom and reality. So, what is Christianity's thought? Paragraph 207. The unhappy consciousness itself, which again is a single undivided consciousness with a dual nature, the unhappy consciousness itself is the gazing of one self-consciousness into another, and itself is both. You have to hold on to that sentence, typical Hegelian sentence. It is one self-consciousness, namely the empirical self-consciousness, gazing into another self-consciousness, the transcendental ego, or now he's going to call it changeable consciousness and unchangeable, and is both. Why is it both? Why is it gazing in one self-consciousness into another self-consciousness and is both? Because it doesn't think of the other as simply another outside of it, but rather the other as its truth. My truth is God. God is my creator. He is my source. I am founded in God. I am made by God. My being exists for God. And at some point, the difference between my life down here and God will be united. We'll be a couple. We'll be a team. We'll make it. We'll make it. That's a happy moment in the life of unhappy consciousness. We call it the honeymoon, right? It's all downhill from there. The other point I want to make is there is no beyond. Just to remind you, there is no beyond. So whatever we know about the beyond is what the concrete consciousness thinks about the beyond. So everything that's important about the beyond comes from, right, how the Christian soul thinks about it. So there's going to be, and I think of a great deal of Hegel is actually a form of a joke. It's a joke that I first heard in a movie with Peter O'Toole called The Ruling Class. Great movie that seems to disappear. It's a bizarre Baroque movie about the British class system. And Peter O'Toole is a mad aristocrat who comes to believe he's God. And finally someone says to him, "Why do you think you're God? I mean, that's an insane. Why do you think it's easy. Whenever I'm praying, I discover I'm talking to myself." That's the entire structure of this chapter. That joke is the structure of this chapter. That every attempt to get outside the self is going to be a reversion back into the self, so that the attempt to affirm oneself as other is always going to be an act of self-affirmation. Jokes can take us a fair way. Okay. So, yeah.
It's reminding me a lot of the spirit of Christianity and what's going on with Abraham and the Jewish people and the ideals that are actually coming from them, but as that denying that they are coming from them. But I guess, so is this relating? Is Hegel thinking of that again?
He's going to be thinking of that. The way it's going to happen here, for reasons that I'll come to, is that, and I'll come to it, it's paragraph 210. The way it comes here is as a moment in the history of Christianity itself. So Judaism appears here, at least in this chapter, slightly differently in chapter on religion, but in this chapter, it appears as Paul's past. That he was once Saul. So that's a moment. So it's a moment in Christianity. It's a moment of the Trinity. God the Father. So, come back to that. So yeah, but it's obviously an analogous problematic, but really set to very different purposes here. And again, the purposes, again, have to pick up this problem of embodiment, labor, work, existence, freedom. All these problems have to come back in this context. And therefore, different than they were in the spirit of Christianity. So the structure, Hegel suggests, paragraph 208, is that this immediate unity, I am both, needs some articulation, and therefore the articulation comes by thinking of the unchangeable as the essential being, and the other, the protein and changeable, it takes to be the unessential. So I'm saying Christianity arises by taking a strategy I suggested last week as the opposite of both Stoicism and Skepticism. They both want to claim their essentiality directly and repudiate their moment of empiricism. Christianity begins with its moment of empiricism, its unessentiality, and thinks of its essence as what is to be achieved or what it is to be connected with. So the motions of Christianity begin with, as it were, the problem of how a merely finite, and again, this is part of the genius of Christianity, a merely finite, merely changeable, merely fallen, et cetera, being can nonetheless be truly self-conscious. That is, be in touch with what makes the world one, with universality and truth. So it's an unhappy consciousness, it's unhappiness, is the thought that it's going to begin from the side of the changeable and try to put itself in relationship to the unchangeable.
How's that not an appearance of Plato? How's that not a version of Plato? Like you said earlier, Plato doesn't appear.
Because it's a matter, because it's an effort. There's no intellectual intuition. There's got to be, it's got to be, in other words, Platonism is an explanation of how we are in touch. Christianity, on this account, is a series of efforts to bring the two into contact, to reconcile.
So, how do I want to say it?
Christianity is Platonism has brought within the world of work and life, and not outside it. So it's a Platonism that no longer has as its premise the repudiation of work. It can, because it's beginning with the empirical moment.
Adorno knows the history of metaphysics, and he says, you know, Plato divides up these two worlds, but he doesn't connect the two worlds. So that's not metaphysics. We don't have metaphysics until Aristotle,
right,
where Aristotle actually connects these two.
Right.
But the problem there is, as soon as we connect the particular with the universal, we want to say the universal is the more important, and so, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. In that case, why don't we get the unhappy consciousness until Christianity? Why don't we just find it as soon as we have Aristotle? Plato, Stoicism, skepticism, okay, but then as soon as we've got Aristotle, where we begin with the empirical world, then don't we have the unhappy consciousness?
Ernest Bloch, in a beautiful book, The Principle of the Handbook, says there are two models of human self-realization in Western philosophy. The first is the Aristotelian, the idea of the virtuous man, the self-sufficient man, the man who is complete in himself, etc. The other is Christ on the cross. Aristotelianism is a kind of Stoicism, isn't very unhappy, still inhabits, malgré lui, a world of slavery. I mean, you can go on and on. So, as much as we Aristotelians love Aristotle, he participated in a Platonic world in all sorts of ways. So you need the dynamism, something, and it's not an accident. I should say, you know, you ought to think about the history of sociology. Is always about the history of religion, history of Christianity, because it has been the dynamic moving force of Western thought. It's needed Greek philosophy, right? Christianity wouldn't be nowhere without Greek philosophy, but it's Christianity that sets it into motion, that makes it a secularizing process. And that's what Hegel's interested in here. He's actually interested in how Christianity itself, as religion, is essentially secularizing. That's what distinguishes it from all other religions. And that will become even more evident in the chapter on religion, where he really describes all the religions and thinks that Christianity is superior precisely for that reason. Christianity is already a form of atheism. Take that to be a truism, but. But obviously it doesn't go without saying. But I'll say it next semester in office. All right, let me see if I can finish paragraph 208 anyway. And then we'll have a break. Because we then get into the structure, a little bit of the structure of the chapter. So Hegel describes from the get-go, in paragraph 208, what the movement of this relationship between the changeable and the unchangeable is going to be. There are no surprises here, and he wants to make that palpable. So he says, this is the very end of the paragraph, the attitude it assigns to both cannot therefore be one of mutual indifference, i.e. it cannot itself be indifferent towards the unchangeable. Rather, it sets itself directly, it is itself directly both of them, and the relation of the two is for it a relation of essential being to the unessential, so that the latter has to be set aside. Christianity is the practice of how we can set aside the unessential motive. But since, and here's the problem, this is again what I just did, this is the logical joke, but since for it both are equally essential and contradictory, it is merely the contradictory movement in which one opposite does not come to rest in its opposite, but in it only produces itself afresh as an opposite. So the claim here is that the structure of Christianity, which later on I will suggest Judy Butler shows is equally the structure of conscious life in Freud, same structure, is an essentially contradictory structure, in which you have an essential moment, which is what's called universal, unchanging, and ideal, and a second moment, which is empirical, finite, living and moving, changeable. Changeable is an important word here. And therefore, if you suppose that your essence, you are this finite being, but this other is your essence, then the trick will be, how can I set myself aside? How can I get rid of, shed my empirical being in order to allow me to realize my unchanging essence? And because the structure of that, how can I, as finite, do the setting aside? Well, the doing is a finite work, and therefore every effort of setting aside is going to be another movement in which I affirm my own finitude. So the very act of trying to overcome my finite, bodily, empirical existence insists upon it, doubles it, makes it more insistent, more palpable. And we'll see this reaches comic extremes in Luther in the Privy. Wow, Luther in the Privy. You missed that bit. I can see from your faces. You didn't see that sentence. We will come back to that. Let us have a break. We will come back to Luther's hat. I'll think about that.
Awesome. Yes.